Welcome to the Grape Nation, your weekly wine journey. We are broadcasting live from the Heritage Radio Network Teepee at the Charleston Wine and Food Festival in Charleston, South Carolina. We have a distinguished panel of guests. Our guests are Eric Asimov, Doug Flamer. Doug, did I get that right? Doug Flamer. And Courtney Maley. Doug is the proprietor of Ingleside Vineyards, one of Virginia's oldest and largest wineries. Ingleside makes over 18 types of award-winning wines from estate-grown grapes. Doug has also helped shape the wine industry in Virginia. He's the past president of the Virginia Wineries Association and a bunch of other important organizations. Courtney Maley is the founder of Blue Bee Cider, Richmond, Virginia's first urban cidery. Courtney left the corporate world. I guess you threw your arms up and said, that's it. And she started Blue Bee 2012, 2013? Okay. And we also have Eric Asimov. Eric Asimov is a friend to Heritage Radio and has appeared on a bunch of shows. Eric is the chief wine critic of the New York Times. His columns appear weekly as The Pour. Eric recently published a couple of books, How to Love Wine, A Memoir and Manifesto, and Wine with Food, Pairing Notes and Recipes from the New York Times. Those books, of course, are available on Amazon and at all booksellers. So I want to thank everyone for joining us. Doug, Eric, Courtney, welcome to the show. So let me get started with Doug and Courtney. So I guess the festival goes out of their way to feature and highlight Virginia winemakers. You know, there's enough beer and wine and liquor. But amongst that, you know, as Virginian, geographically, you know, we're not that far away. So you've been coming here how long, Doug? I mean,
we've been down, I think this is our sixth year.
Okay.
Ever since the Virginia Wine Marketing Office decided that Charleston was a good place for us to go.
Right. And Doug, you're sort of like the OG of Virginia wines. You know what that is?
No, I don't.
All right. Should I tell him, Eric? OG is original gangster. That's the guy that was there first.
I think you have
first.
To tell me, too.
Okay. That's the guy that was there first, did it, still doing it, and everybody looks up to him. And, you know, you've sort of earned that designation. Now, Courtney, on the other hand, Courtney is sort of part of the new breed. Courtney, you, just quickly, you worked in the corporate world.
Yes.
In finance?
Economic development.
Economic development, and something drove you to throw your arms up and say, I'm not doing this anymore.
Yes, well, and I knew that pretty much the first month that I started working in the corporate world, but I had some student loans to work my way through before I could give it all up.
Right, and I know you come from a wine family.
My uncle is one of the founders of Walla Walla Vintners,
right,
in Washington State.
Mm-hmm. So fermenting stuff or, you know, bottling stuff wasn't foreign to you. But when did you hatch the idea that you would leave and start a cidery?
Well, I was about to turn 40, so a seminal birthday, and I decided it was time to stop doing what I didn't want to do anymore and start doing what I did want to do. And I actually had a conversation with Uncle Miles the summer before I threw it all into the air. And I knew that I didn't want to make reds because he was doing really well with that. And Virginia already had a lot of whites. So what kind of a wine are you going to make if you're not going to make reds or whites? And ultimately, I chose cider, which is a wine, but it's made with apples instead
right.
of grapes.
And we'll talk about that in a minute.
Yep.
But you did something interesting.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you think of cideries, you know, they're upstate New York, they're in Vermont, they're in Washington. You
mm-hmm.
decided to open a cidery pretty much in and around downtown Richmond, right?
Yes.
So you're growing some grapes and contracting some grapes?
Well, apples.
Apples,
yes.
I'm sorry.
That's okay. So,
I'm around grapes too much.
When I was apprenticing out in the western part of the state and started looking at places to set up a cidery and it was time to make a decision, I said, husband, let's move west. And he said, no, let's not. My job is here. So I needed to try, at least try, to find a way to make the business model work where we brought the raw materials down the mountain
right.
and made it in the city.
You wanted to be closer to the market.
Yes.
I mean, where you serve and hold the cider, you were right there.
Exactly right. So that's why it turned out to be a really good decision.
Right. And Doug, you're sort of the opposite. I mean, you've been on that property way back before the 80s. I mean, why and how did you get started quickly?
Yeah, well, we have quite a family history on the property where we are. Been there since 1890, my family. Not me personally, but... and I'm actually second generation.
I was going to say, you look good.
Well, my father had the idea to start a winery in Virginia, and this was in the late 70s when there were four, five, six wineries. We started officially in 1980, there were eight wineries. I think now they're up to 280-some, so it's been quite a growth. But although my dad had the idea, he enlisted me to do the grunt work, and so I've been there from the beginning and loving it. I even met my wife at a wine event, so I feel like I'm pretty much a wine geek all the way through.
So the family had property.
Yes.
I mean, you hit the ground running.
Yes.
There were vines to plant, vines planted
yes.
already around
Well, we
there.
Planted, my dad planted vines, and then they grew well. We made some home wine. People were clamoring to get that homemade wine. We said, well, what could we do if we really set up and did it as a business? And things just took off from there.
Wow. Let's talk about, you know, Eric talks a lot about in columns and in books about terroir, you know, the place where wine is grown, the people that grow it. You hear a lot about the terroir, certainly in France. They talk about it in Napa. I mean, I'll be the first to tell you, I don't know the first thing about the terroir for apples or for grapes in Virginia. I don't, you know, tell me about the terroir as far as growing grapes. Doug, you grow a ton of varieties.
Yes.
And Courtney, I know you use a lot of varieties and you move towards that. But what are we talking about? Are we talking about soils that are easy to work with? Is it challenging? The weather window? I mean, just give me a quick snapshot into...
Yeah, Virginia, most people wouldn't suspect that that's the great place to grow grapes because of the climate. Soil's not so much an issue. There are all types of soil conditions in Virginia throughout the state. Grapes can adapt to that pretty well, but it's the microclimate where you're planting, and then varietals. And of course, now we know clones and rootstocks are important to where you're actually located. And Virginia is young. We're still learning a lot, improving every year.
So through the years, you've done a lot of experimenting with which grapes grow where. And
we've almost revamped our entire vineyard over the 39 years that we've been growing and making wine.
So, I mean, this show's less than 40 minutes. So we don't have time, but tick off a few varieties that you grow in bottle. There's some interesting stuff in there.
Yeah, Virginia has still figuring out what they can do, but you'll find the main ones now. Of course, everybody's growing Cabernet Sauvignon, Merlot, for whites, Chardonnay, you'll see. Not so much Riesling. We're too hot.
Okay.
A few microclimates, but... We've discovered other varieties from other regions, like Viognier has done very well.
Really? Nice aromatic grape.
Yes. The latest thing that we're really excited about is Albariño, the Spanish grape.
A white Spanish grape, nice crisp grape.
It does well in the region of Spain that it comes from, which is a little more humid and moist, which Virginia certainly can claim to be in that category. So... We're still finding out. We have Italian varieties, you know, that we're playing with. So there'll be a Portuguese varieties. You'll see a lot of different varieties, and different regions will sort of show those to different.
So styles. Albariño is something you've been experimenting, growing, and something you've added to the bullpen in the past few years. I mean, obviously, you're putting stuff on. Do you ever realize or find it's tough to grow grapes and just move away from that and replant?
Yes.
You do that too?
We've abandoned some varieties.
What's been a tough haul as far as...
Well, we have Sangiovese, the Italian grape.
Not easy.
Not easy. Doesn't okay. like wet, but we, you know, end up making a lot of risotto out of that.
That's a good way to put it to good use. Now, Courtney, you contract a lot of apples, but you have some property where you're growing.
Yes.
What are the plans? And
so, in terms of terroir,
right?
There are some apples that we grow in Virginia that are grown in other apple-growing regions around the country. Pippin and Winesap are two of the really key apples in Virginia. Pippin is a very calcium-hungry apple, and the Shenandoah Valley has this huge lime deposit that washes through the whole valley.
So that's
Pippins
good for that.
Grow really, really well there. Two more rare varieties that we're growing more of in Virginia now are Harrison and Hughes, and Blue Bee Cider is still the largest commercial producer of Harrison in the world. It used to be the most popular apple for cider at the end of the colonial era, and it's one of the varieties that we're bringing back from extinction.
So how many different apples are you dealing with variety-wise?
It really depends.
It depends on harvest.
Apples are very biennial, so we'll have good years and bad years, and some years we'll have 16 to choose from, and some will have
right.
more or less.
Because with grapes, you know, the yield varies,
yes.
the acidity and all that, but it's still that one grape, a Cabernet right. grape or whatever. Eric, I thank you for coming by and sitting with us.
My pleasure.
I just wanted you to tell everyone what brings you down to Charleston. You're doing a bunch of events at the festival, right?
Yeah, this is the third festival that I've been to, and it's always a pleasure to be here. You know, with a lot of these sorts of food and wine festivals are held all over the country, and often they can seem rather generic because you're just parachuting a bunch of people into a place and they do their thing, but it has nothing to do with you know, the culture of the region. But the culture of Charleston is so strong and indigenous that people come here and adapt themselves to the place. So the place here has a lot of power to it, and I think that makes it a really worthy kind of festival.
The festival magnifies that.
Yeah.
They're very supportive of that.
So this year I did a wine dinner last night. We chose some really interesting and esoteric wines to go with a meal at Fig. And tomorrow I'm going to do two seminars, one on Cru Beaujolais and the other on sparkling wines beyond champagne.
Right. Are you going to even talk about champagne or go beyond and talk
well,
about...
Well, I included one champagne in the lineup just for comparison purposes.
Okay.
But,
more for reference.
But, you know, there's so many different sparkling wines in the world, and they are you can make them of any kind of grape. There are a number of different methods, including an ancient one that's been resurrected and has become quite popular, Pétillon Naturel, it's
right.
called now.
A once-fermented, sparkling, natural wine.
Right.
Right.
And, you know, if you... I wouldn't be surprised if Doug makes a sparkling
Doug
wine.
Doug does, and has been for a while, right?
You know, it's...
And you're sparkling.
Yeah. So, you know, when you travel around the world and you visit wine producers, very often, you know, winemakers are like chefs. They're always experimenting and trying different things. So, you know, you'll go visit a guy in Bordeaux, but he makes a little sparkling wine for himself because it's fun.
Hey, Eric, come here and taste this. Yeah. You know, I got two barrels.
Right.
That's fun.
So, you know, it's interesting, and it's I think it's worth exploring what else is available
well,
beyond the familiar.
Let's tick off a few things. In the sparkling wine world, let's tell people about three, four things. There's Cremant. There's from France, Franciacorta. Everybody knows Prosecco Cava. Tell me some
yeah.
of the things, you know, that you're...
Well, Cava is an interesting example. Cava is the sparkling wine from Spain, and we're most familiar with it in this country in this sort of very cheap, mass-produced bottles that back when I was a college student, you bought the bottle to get drunk, and then you had a candlestick for the rest of your life.
Nice candle holder.
And nowadays, you're not allowed to burn a candle in a college dorm anymore, I'm told.
Right.
But, you know, in the last few years, we've seen some really super serious kava producers who are not just, you know, rolling out millions of bottles, but are taking great care in their vineyard because they've got a set of grapes that are the main one. Zarello is virtually grown nowhere else in the world.
Right.
And, you know, there was a time when cava producers were replacing Zarello with Pinot Noir and Champagne and Chardonnay in imitation of Champagne. But the best ones are now emphasizing their own indigenous
varieties. Grapes, right.
And of course, cava is made with the Champagne method. So if you put a lot of care into it, you can make a really good sparkling wine and show off the qualities of these grapes in this land. And so I found some really interesting cavas.
So let's get specific for a second, because there's some good mass market cavas that are not a bad value for low teens, 12,
yes.
13. I think you're talking about a little more artisanal, but not that much more.
But even, you know,
give me a maker or two.
Raventa Z Blanc, excellent. Cremona, Recaredo.
And retail, we're talking...
Well, they can go anywhere from, you know, $15 or $20 for the entry level wine, but you also see some, you know, you can find some cavas that go into the three figures because of you know, those are made in very small quantities, and you have to be really a cava aficionado to check those out. But you know, it goes way beyond
But there's a lot of good product.
Yes.
In the entry and right above that.
Yeah.
For sparkling wine with the same experience. I want to jump to... finish your thought.
No, just to say we'll also be tasting in this seminar. We'll be doing a Chacolina from Spain, from the Basque
Country. Spell that for everybody. Can you? It starts with an X,
you know,
right?
Luckily, there's a number of ways of spelling it and of pronouncing it, so it depends which
so
way you go.
So it's called Chacolina. It starts with an
X. Chacolina is the Basque version. We'll also have a really good Lambrusco from Italy. That's another
very fun
kind of wine that was despised and discarded, but now we're getting really good kind of farmhouse varieties of Lambrusco that are wonderful. We'll have a Petit Naturel. We'll have.
I think it's an underappreciated wine. It's great with pizza and other food.
Yeah.
I think if you bring it to a dinner or serve it to friends, they're like, what is this? You know, and there's some crappy stuff, but again, you know, there's some good entry level and some good makers. So, Chacolina, Lambrusco, Cava, little Champagne you mentioned. Give me one other
one.
Yeah,
we'll have a Petit Naturel and a sparkling Vouvray.
Vouvray from the
Loire Valley.
Is that a Chenin based wine?
That is entirely Chenin based.
Chenin based. That's something people should look at too. I want to jump quickly to Cru Beaujolais, which you're doing a tasting. I don't know if it's me, but all of a sudden it's like my favorite wine. It's delicious. The price is incredible. It's a great food friendly wine. I'm saying everything you should be saying. There's some terrific makers. What is it about Cru Beaujolais now? Are they getting their recognition? Is it better stuff?
Well, it's a number of things. You know, if you looked at the Beaujolais region 15 years ago, it was in serious crisis. And the major reason for that was the worldwide popularity of Beaujolais Nouveau.
That Thanksgiving
if
crappy
you remember
grape
this,
juice.
This Beaujolais Nouveau phenomenon, from the 1970s. This was a harvest, a local harvest treat. After the harvest came in, there would be a big party for the winemakers and all the people, and they would drink some of the local wine from the harvest, and it would just be a newly formed, you know, on the cusp of being juice, and you know, it was just a joyous tradition. Georges Dubuff primarily transformed that into a worldwide phenomenon by mass producing this wine, and the compromises required in the mass production, buying grapes before they were actually ripe, manipulating them in the winery.
Everything you shouldn't do in winemaking.
Virtually pasteurizing the wines and shipping them all over the world. But it was big bucks, and a lot of farmers adopted their work to serving this market. And then when that market crashed and died pretty much everywhere in the world except for Japan, these guys were left with nothing. You know, meanwhile, the reputation of Beaujolais was of this just simple, you know, kind of knock it back wine, which is fine, and Beaujolais does that wonderfully, but it can also be a more serious wine, and especially when you get grapes from the best terroirs in the 10 cru regions
right.
in the north.
Let's remind people, Beaujolais is Burgundy.
Yeah. And those are you know, somewhat familiar names like Moulin Avant, Morgon, Fleury,
Foyard,
Brilly, Julienas. And these grapes, which are grown in granite, and if you're very careful with the farming and with the winemaking, they are not simply simple, joyous wines. They're actually quite complex,
yes.
and they can be age-worthy, which is another... you know, the cliche is drink it within a year or whatever, and
right.
and those wines are fine when they're young, but they can really evolve and improve as well. So
yeah, I think that's catching everyone's attention.
Yeah, well, you know, people are discovering this, so prices are going up, so it's not quite the great
I know.
Deal that
unfortunately
it used to
that
be,
always but. Happens, and when it starts making lists,
yeah,
people you know run to the list and all of that. Doug and Courtney, I want to ask you about, you know, past vintage and all that, but I want to ask Eric first. We're not that deep into the year yet. So quickly, when we look back to 2017, is there any trend or thing or wine or something that, you know, happened that, you know, really resonated or, you know, got you thinking? Was there an event, a wine, a breakthrough?
Well, I don't know. One way of answering that was that, 2017 was a year that climate change really took a toll on wine production. And by climate change, I don't just mean global warming. I mean the extremes of weather. So yes, you had most obviously the fires in Northern California. Throughout France and much of Europe, you had terrible early frosts in the year. And this is clearly a product of climate change. When you have when the climate is warmer and your vines you know, go through bud break and flowering early, and then it turns cold, and this can, you know, in some cases it destroyed 100% of people's productions, and so all over France in particular, you're going to see production quite a bit lower in Bordeaux, in Champagne, Chablis, a bunch of other places, and of course in Northern California, you've got the potential residue from the fires. It's
right.
That's not clear
we
yet.
We haven't even figured that
but,
out.
But I think the important thing is to realize that this is just the beginning. And,
well, what's
you know, I mean, we're not, if we just don't, if we don't do anything about it, I don't know what we can do at this point anyway, but if we just, like, give it all up, you know, we have to be prepared for major changes in wine.
You know, I asked you the question, and it sort of alluded to, you know, what was the hot wine, what was the hot trend, what was the hot region?
You know,
and interestingly, you know, you gave a very important answer. which affects, you know, everyone, farmers, consumers, and all that.
It does.
If people don't get a sense of how global, you know, warming climate change is affecting a particular product, you know, they don't realize what's going on. And I guess you're right. You'll see it in crop yields, pricing, availability, and all of that stuff. So that's a good point. Now, Doug, the past couple of years, harvest-wise, weather-wise?
Well, we're well prepared for the changing of the global climate because Virginia experiences that every year. You know, warm spring, late frost, particularly even with apples. I know Courtney has to suffer through every spring whether they're going to lose their crop. So we get variable weather, and so we're pretty prepared for that.
So it's happening, but it's not.
And every harvest is different. Yeah. You know, the rains can come. Because we grow so many varieties, it gives us a little bit of a break that we not all everything in one basket. So usually something will come right at the optimum time each year so we can salvage a good harvest.
Right. And what about with apples? I mean,
Apples have... Apples have a longer period of bloom.
Less sensitivity, do you think?
Well, so we have early bloomers, regular, and late bloomers, and the wine grapes tend to be more in a narrower window. So we have a little bit more, I guess, room to play. If the early bloomers get snapped, we'll have late bloomers.
Right. Eric, I wanted to ask you, in your last article in The Pour this week, you talked about Pomerol is a region, and you'll help me steer it. I think I understood it, which is, you know, arguably one of the most famous regions for famous wines, Petrus and all of that. But I think what you got into was even regions like that, there are vigneron's winemakers that are making, you know, terrific wines that are not necessarily the most expensive. And, you know, I don't know if people look beyond the big guys. So two questions. I want you to talk a little more about that. But is there a story like that, you know, in every region? I mean, I realize Bordeaux is sort of... Is there a story like that in Burgundy where there's the trophy guy, but in the background?
Yeah, I mean, there's two parts to that question. You know, every region has its kind of famous... leaders, emblematic producers, and so on, and there are always people that are relatively unknown or undiscovered, and you know, it's great fun when you can find people like that and give their wine some exposure. But what particularly interested me in Pomerol was the contrast between the usual formula in Bordeaux, which you know, is a huge and important region, but in many in terms of status with many younger people, with many people in the wine trade, sommeliers and so on, is kind of nosedived in this century, because the emphasis in Bordeaux has essentially become a luxury good in many people's eyes, and they've embraced the marketing elements of it. And if you look at you know, Champagne is a good analogy. The big houses in Champagne among the cutting edge wine people have become kind of ignored because of their emphasis on the marketing of wine over the agriculture of it, and so people. American wine culture started looking at Burgundy, and Burgundy, with its emphasis on small farmers, the importance of terroir, and this connotation of authenticity, kind of replaced Bordeaux in the American mindset as the paradigm of what wine production should be. And, you know, I have fought back against that a little bit by pointing out that both Bordeaux has a history that can't be denied or dismissed, but also that there are vignerons, small farmers, who make Bordeaux.
Explain quickly what a vigneron is.
A vigneron is a French term that doesn't really have an American translation. It's the person who grows the grapes and transforms it into wine.
Grower and maker.
Yeah, but it's almost like it's more, the connotation is more of a shepherd,
right?
You know,
own land.
Yeah, I mean you're shepherding the grapes along in their journey to the bottle.
Right.
So it you know, winemaker has a little bit of a you know, an industrial suggestion to it. Your
right.
Your
good point.
Your factory, but.
Good point.
You know, so there are people like that in Bordeaux and Pomerol, especially a famous region. This is the source of Petrus and Lepin, and, you know, wines that cost hundreds of dollars if you could find them. But all of these are small family estates. They have not become the sort of property of multinational corporations or
right.
You know, luxury goods executives who want to own a chateau somewhere. And so there's a,
will they survive?
I called it a the Burgundy of Bordeaux.
Right.
Which they don't really appreciate, but it captures the sense. Will it survive? You know, that's a really good question.
Because they're not marketing heavily. That's not where they're focusing.
No, and their land is super valuable. And what happens in family estates in this situation, when you have to pass it on to a new generation, this is beginning to happen in Burgundy too, you know, unless you've prepared really well far in advance, you have enormous amount of inheritance taxes to pay. And French law requires the property to be split among, you know, siblings, and you might have family members who just want to cash out. So it becomes very much of a difficulty, and it's really, I mean, not to put it in political terms, but it's an income disparity issue.
Right.
When something is of great value, prices just rise to that level, and you know, the people for whom money means very little are the ones who move in.
Yeah.
So
So that was this week's column. That was an interesting column. I mean, there's more insight if you obviously read the whole column. We're going to wrap up in a couple of minutes, but before I let you go, I kind of enjoy a column you do every year. You go out pretty much on your own to retailers, and you seek out the best bottles of wine for around $20.
Yeah.
We do a little feature on the show where we ask our guests, you know, what should we be drinking for that price range? I got two takeaways from it. One, you know, there were some incredible recommendations, some I knew about, a lot I didn't. But you make a point about buying wine in a price region that regardless, like $10 or less, it's just going to be crap. Because how it's made, you got to kind of raise the bar a little, and the experience is so much better. And, you know, here's at least 20 examples. Talk to me a little about that.
Well, you know, it goes to price. It goes to the definition of value. For me, it's the price-quality ratio, which in wine, you know, depending on where you live, is somewhere from $15 to $25 a bottle.
To some people, that's expensive.
Yes, absolutely. And then it comes down to people's priorities in life. And I don't ever tell people what their priorities should be.
Right.
But you know, for the most part, if you're a $10 bottle is going to be, it's going to be sound, and it could be enjoyable, but it will very rarely be exciting. And if you just want a pleasant alcohol delivery system, that's fine. But if you're interested in something more, some wine that speaks of a place, that has a little bit of excitement to it, and you're willing to spend just a little bit more money, your pleasure will increase exponentially.
Not that much more, which
no.
is kind of the point, and the experience, like you said, is exponential.
You know, in this level, you're not getting so many mass-produced wines or you know, I call them processed wines, which is the, you know, the analogy to processed foods.
Right.
People who don't mind eating processed foods won't mind processed wines. But if you are, if you care about what you eat, where it came from, how it was made, then I think you should, you might want to devote the same attention to detail with wine. And
right.
you might spend a little bit more to get your food from a farmer's market.
Organic.
It's worth a little bit more to get your wine from a producer who is really scrupulous in agriculture and not manipulating it in the winery.
I agree. Now, we're going to wrap up, but if people did not see the story, they can go online and they could look up that particular article, the $20, right? Where would they go?
Yeah. Well, nytimes.com is, you know,
so your starting place.
My column's going back forever, it seems.
Right. So if you want to read any of Eric's work, current column or back, just go to NewYorkTimes.com.
Go to Google.
Go to Google. Yeah. Put in Eric Asimov, $20 bottles of wine. All right, we're going to wrap up. Doug, if people want to know more about Ingleside Vineyards, where's the best place? Because not everybody lives in Virginia. Not everybody gets by there. But hopefully we piqued a little interest. So if people want to know more about Ingleside, where do they start?
I would say start with Google.
Start with Google? God, if things change, right?
Look us up online. And
damn it.
We'll have a nice website that'll get you started, and we'd love to have people come visit.
And you have a tasting room and all that, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So go to Ingleside, go to Google. And Courtney, you are in Richmond. Like I said, you're an urban cidery. If people want to know more, get more information about
BlueBeastCider.com.
BlueBeastCidery. I knew that. Yeah.
And you can come and visit. We're located in the Scotts Addition neighborhood in Richmond. It's Alcohol Central. Right now there are 10 producers in the neighborhood, breweries, wineries, cideries, meaderies, distilleries. So park your car and have a good time.
It's a very, I know you moved recently. You're in a very cool multi-building space.
Yes.
And if you could quickly tell me, I know you're doing a fundraiser coming up in March.
Yes.
To raise money for human trafficking.
Yes, the human trafficking.
Talk to me quickly about
what. Yes. So the Human Trafficking Institute helps work with existing justice systems to prosecute and put in jail people who are breaking the law by asking people to work for little to no money. And we're doing this during Women's History Month because women tend to be the most vulnerable in the hospitality industry and agriculture to that kind of treatment.
And when is that?
That's March 21st.
At
Blue Bee Cider, and you can purchase tickets at BlueBeeCider.com.
So go to Blue Bee Cider, and you can get more info on the cidery and on that event.
Yes.
All right, we're going to wrap up. I want to thank Doug Flemmer from Ingleside Vineyards. I want to thank Courtney Maley from Blue Bee Cider, and I want to thank our friend Eric Asimov from the New York Times for joining us on the Grape Nation. We're broadcasting today at the Charleston Wine and Food Festival. I also would like to thank our sponsors, Springer Mountain Farms Chicken, which is right behind us, and the smoke's blowing in, and it's hard to miss it. The Big Green Egg, Wisconsin Cheese, and the Julia Child Foundation. We'll be back with more programming.